Hello, everyone, and welcome to Hashtag No Limits. I am your host, Shelley Kino, and today joining me is Shannon Iacobacci, and I hope I said that right. Awesome. She taught me how to say it ahead of time, so hopefully I was really practicing. Hashtag No Limits is about people whose society has placed limits upon, but who have busted through those limits. And Ophelia says in Hamlet, we know who we are, but not who we will be. And I believe that 100% to be true, and that there is no better example of that than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. The caterpillar literally dissolves itself into its cells, and then it reforms into a butterfly. And as if that wasn't enough, then it has to struggle to get out of the cocoon in order for its wings to be strong enough to fly. And just like that is no easy task, neither is busting through the limits that society has placed upon a person. Shannon comes to us today with a unique situation, a unique diagnosis, actually, that is not new, but it's kind of new at the same time. And it's more prevalent than most people even know about. So I'm not going to share all of that stuff with you, but make sure if you are watching, you know, got to do the whole business side, give us a thumbs up, give us a like, subscribe if you're watching on the YouTube channel, and let us know if you're watching. This is actually only going to be in replay version, so let me know if you're watching it. And if you have any questions for Shannon, pop them into the chat, and I'll be sure to get them to her and have her answer them at her convenience. So, Shannon, thank you so much for joining me today, and welcome. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you for having me here. I'm excited.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us a little bit about yourself, and then like I was talking about, what is this unique diagnosis that I was talking about?
Okay. So as you said, my name is Shannon Iacobacci. I am a mom, and first and foremost, highest priority. And
that's always good.
Of six children, four of which have varying neurodevelopmental disabilities. And I am a facilitator of a neurobehavioral model created by Facets Organization. And I'm also a parent coach, and I teach on what we're going to talk about today so that I can share starter strategies for improved outcomes for individuals with developmental disabilities. That's kind of what I do.
That's awesome. And yes, you and I have a similar background in that we are both master IEP coaches, have both gone through the mentorship, but we are also, as you said, we're coaches, we're facilitators. As master IEP coaches, we try to bring a different view, thinking outside the box, bring different ideas, and really coach parents. But I don't know about you, but for me, I also work with school districts and just trying to help everybody at the IEP table. I'm a former special education teacher, and so I can bring that teacher perspective into it as well. So tell us, what is, and I'm going to spill it for you right now. What is fetal alcohol spectrum disorder?
Fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is actually an umbrella term. It is not an actual diagnosis at this point, so it's not in the DSM-5, say, as a diagnosis. What would be in the DSM-5 for an actual diagnosis would be like alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorder, or PAE, prenatal alcohol exposure, the ARND, alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorder. So those are what are actually in the DSM-5. FASD is for fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. This disorder is just like it sounds. It's a spectrum, which is why it's the umbrella term to encompass all of the things underneath. And what that is when a child is exposed to alcohol in utero, they have the potential of having fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And what that is basically, it does not matter when, the timing, the type, or the amount of alcohol that is exposed, a child could end up with a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And what that means is it's a developmental disability. It is a physical disability. It impacts the brain and central nervous system and potentially organs and the whole body. Okay. So, but there are a lot of variables in how individuals are impacted. So like I had said, based on timing and type and amount, and epigenetics and genetics. It's going to impact that growing fetus differently, each one of them. Even if you have twins or multiples in utero, they can be impacted differently as well. So that is basically, I mean, in a quick nutshell, what fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is. A child will not receive an FASD diagnosis if the mom or the mom basically doesn't drink any alcohol during pregnancy. Okay. There can be, so for example, if my partner, drank alcohol, there could be developmental disabilities that take place, or early, you know, easier, what's the word I'm looking for? Miscarriage. You know, you can have higher rates of miscarriage, higher rates of, you know, other things, but the child will not receive an FASD diagnosis.
Okay. So
you know, a lot of information really fast, right?
Yeah. So I just want to make sure that I heard you correctly.
Okay.
So in so many eligibilities for special education and so many medical diagnoses, it does all seem to fall on mom's shoulders. But what I heard you say is that isn't necessarily the case, because you said mom doesn't have to drink at all, but it's the dad that may have had some alcohol that could also be affecting. Did I get that right?
Yes. But what I'm saying is that, again, there will not be a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder diagnosis. And right. So therefore the child will not have fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. But what I'm saying is if the male partner consumes alcohol, then there are higher chances of there are different developmental disorders that can take place. The cell development happens, you know, the cell splitting, all of the things that are taking place, a higher rate of miscarriage, but it is not diagnosed as fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. In order to have that, it has to be that the pregnant mother is the one that consumed the alcohol. It's the only way.
Okay. However, so the diagnosis may not be there, but the effects could be the same.
There can be some effects. It has not been highly researched. It's trying to be researched right now. It's a very difficult research topic, my words are escaping me. It's being researched, but it has not completely, we don't have results yet.
Yeah. So one of the things that you mentioned was depending on the time or the amount. Mm-hmm. So it's been a long time since I was pregnant. But I would think in regards to the research that if a child is thought to have fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and they ask the mom, did you drink or did you have alcohol at any time during your pregnancy? In a 9 or 10 month time span of being pregnant, I may or may not have. And especially if you're asking me 2, 3, 5, maybe 10, I don't know how long it could be, if I had alcohol during my pregnancy. So you're saying even if I had had one drink, one alcoholic drink, I would need to say yes in order for that to help that research.
Right. See, let me break it down in this. And this is hard because alcohol consumption is a social norm in our society, right? It is a social norm. And yet there is such a stigma associated with, oh my gosh, you drank when you were pregnant. Now, what I'd like to clarify is I personally believe that no woman or no mom intentionally drinks to harm their baby. Okay. So let's just put that out there. Okay. Right. But what can happen is lack of knowledge. Like you mentioned before, it's been a long time since you've been pregnant, right? people don't know they're pregnant in the very beginning stages, right?
Right.
I mean, there are times where it's been 6 weeks, 8 weeks, and someone's gone out and they've gone drinking with friends and they didn't know they were pregnant. And therefore they could have a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And yet the mom could say, well, no, I didn't drink when I was pregnant, but it could be, I didn't drink once I knew I was pregnant.
Right.
Okay. And so therefore that makes it hard. But also so you don't know you're pregnant, possibly, and you may have done, you know, some type of drinking. You also have healthcare professionals that are at odds with each other in regards to this topic. There's a lot of confusion. So even recently, my friend was pregnant and her doctor had stated, a glass of wine a week isn't going to hurt you or the baby. It'll be good for you. Go ahead and have a glass of wine. Relax. I know pregnancy is stressful, like all the things, right?
Yeah.
And so therefore, we put our trust in our medical health professionals.
Absolutely.
And so we're thinking, well, the doctor said it was okay. So obviously it's okay. And we unknowingly drink during pregnancy. Okay.
Right.
Now, what's happened is, like, the CDC recently came out with research that says 1 in 7 pregnancies have had alcohol consumption or alcohol exposure. Okay.
Okay.
Of that, if I have my numbers right, I believe it is like 14%. Oh no, 1 in 20. 1 in 20 have reported binge drinking. So let's put this in perspective, real quick. So binge drinking is considered 4 to 5 servings of alcohol.
Okay.
So now when you think of servings, usually think that's 4 to 5 drinks, right?
Right.
Well, it was put in perspective for me by Dr. Susan Rich, who's very much a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder focus on her practice. And the perspective is 1 Long Island iced tea, just a single Long Island iced tea equals 6 servings of alcohol. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Here's our perspective. We don't realize how much, quote, binge drinking we might be doing. So though these numbers are an alarming number, we must think that it may be also underreported due to the lack of knowledge of what the servings are, due to lack of knowledge that we're pregnant, due to misinformation from our healthcare providers, you know, all those things put together, it's the perfect storm for not knowing. And so, that I just wanted to give that perspective of what binge drinking is. And then the other piece that I wanted to say was it's also underreported because of the stigma.
Right.
There's such a stigma and pressure on women for drinking alcohol. So if you don't drink, you get the pressure from society in your day-to-day life. But if you do drink and you report it to your doctor, now you have the stigma and now you have the shame on you. And I can express that from personal experience. I went to take one of my children to the doctor, and they had a traumatic brain issue that had taken place, and was talking to the neurologist. And in the conversation, it was mentioned that my child had prenatal alcohol exposure. And the doctor's response nearly threw me off my chair, because the doctor literally went forward in her chair, looked at me square in the eye and said, "You drank while you were pregnant?" I mean, just the tone of voice and the accusatory. And I was like, oh my gosh, had I been birth mom who didn't know or drank out, you know, what if I had a substance abuse problem and I needed help to stop the drinking, right? There's that issue too. It's not that I did it intentionally. We all know addiction is addiction. And so trying to stop, I would need help and the proper tools to get me to stop that substance abuse. So that stigma or that shame that is placed from doctors and then society, no one is underreported. So women get the brunt of it all, or the short end of the stick.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to put that in perspective for you about what a serving of alcohol really is.
Yeah. So I am not a Long Island iced tea drinker. So is it possible? Do you know, like, the most common thing around my area to drink is a can of beer.
Okay.
Do you know how many servings a can of beer might be?
I don't know. The only way to know, because each beer is, every alcohol is created differently. And so each serving, you'd have to look on the can to know what constitutes a serving. But even at that, it has been researched and known for years, since the 60s and 70s, right, that alcohol impacts fetal development. Right. And we're just getting the awareness now. And that's why we're saying there is no safe amount to drink while pregnant, because we don't know how that's going to impact the growing fetus. We just have no idea. So it's better to refrain, to have the healthiest pregnancy as possible.
Right. Yeah. Now, and like you said, sometimes, you know, people don't know that they're pregnant because they're not trying. You know, I would say a large portion of the people who end up pregnant are not trying. There are those like myself who had gone through 5 years for me of trying to get pregnant. So we were always, you know, paying attention as soon as possible that, are we pregnant? Are we pregnant? But not everybody does that. So, you know, I mean, I've actually heard stories of people delivering and not knowing they were pregnant up until the moment of delivery.
That is correct. There's 45% of pregnancies are unplanned. 45%. And you're absolutely right. I had a family member who only a week prior to delivering found out she was pregnant.
Yeah.
Surprise.
Yeah.
You know, hello, you're pregnant. Oh, and by the way, you're going in, you know, and you're pregnant. Oh, I'm pregnant. I'm trying to, you know, wrap my head around this. And look, there's a baby. Here you go. You know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So like I said, 45% of pregnancies are unplanned. And then as parents, we're not prepared to handle what fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, what is involved with that.
Right.
Because it's a spectrum, there are so many variables, different brain domains that can be affected, different behaviors that come into play. Because what happens is when the structure, the physical structure of the brain is altered during development, you're going to have challenges. If I have a roadmap that takes me, that I'm supposed to say I'm developing and I'm supposed to go here, you know, go up and turn left, but there's a roadblock there, I got to find another way around it. Right. And that's exactly what happens to our brain in utero in during development when alcohol, which is considered a teratogen is the name for it, when alcohol enters into the developmental process.
Wow. Yeah.
And another thing I wanted to share too, and I know it's a lot of information, but one thing to consider is too, when we were talking about the servings and the alcohol and all of that, yes, it will relax the mom. But one thing we have to consider is an adult can process alcohol differently. The unborn fetus is not fully developed and able to process the alcohol. Okay. So when it enters the bloodstream through the placenta, when it goes straight into the developmental sac or whatever you want to call it, into the bloodstream, the baby processes it at a much slower rate. So long after the effects of the alcohol have worn off on the mom, the developing fetus is still processing that. Now add to it, once the fetus is of age to excrete the alcohol from their system, and it's been, research has shown that they can, it sits in the amniotic sac in the fluid and therefore is redigested and then recycled in the baby. So the so the baby's getting multiple doses of that original serving of alcohol.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That is just crazy. And I think somewhere along the way, I had learned that there is even like a really tiny, very specific window of like day 18 to day 21.
Yes.
So tell about that.
Okay. So though that small window of time, there is another diagnosis called fetal alcohol syndrome. And a lot of people may be familiar with that. A lot of doctors are familiar with fetal alcohol syndrome because that's been the diagnosis for a lot of years. Uh-huh. But in order to have a fetal alcohol syndrome diagnosis, one must have very specific facial features in order to be diagnosed with full fetal alcohol syndrome, or what they call FAS, Okay. And so with that being said, though, that minor, it's such a small window of time. It's such a very specific where they have to do actual measurements and all the things, right? But also understanding that it's hard to tell because of genetics. It's hard to tell as a child ages into, you know, from infant to toddler, like our face changes. And genetically speaking, so facial features, you cannot walk in and say, oh, this person has fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. This person has FASD. You might be able to think, oh, maybe this person might have FAS or maybe something's going on. But really, not really, because it's such a specific, you know, a specific criteria.
So what is it from the, so the 18th to the 21st day of development, is that when they had to have consumed the alcohol in order for that to be the FAS diagnosis?
Yes. Yes. Okay. It has to be within, and because, well, and the reason why is because that's when those facial features are being formed. And so that is when you have the chance. Now I want to be clear. That's not saying that if I drink, you know, between these days, my child will have this. No, that is not what I'm saying. There is the potential of it happening. So I could drink on day 10, skip all those days, drink again, or continue to consume during pregnancy, and my child will not be diagnosed with FAS. My child will not get services because they don't have FAS. They'll have FASD and a wide variety, you know, a wide variety of developmental challenges. Yeah.
That's just so crazy that there, it's so specific. And again, thinking about, you know, myself, who we were on top of, you know, everything and all the milestones, all the, not milestones, all the, signs, I guess, of is a person, am I pregnant or not? And yet you just said, you know, not quite half are unplanned. So there's a lot of people out there who are not paying attention to those days. And again, I think this affects the research too, because even if they've asked you after the child has been born, did you drink during pregnancy? And you said, yeah, maybe I had a glass or two during my whole pregnancy. Are you really going to be able to remember that it was between 18 days and 21 days? I mean, are you even, do you even know the date of conceiving? So
no.
Yeah, I can see how the research behind this has to be so difficult, because it just, I think the information must be almost impossible to be accurate.
Sometimes it feels that way, yes. Sometimes it does feel that way, because, I mean, you've got so many, and you have so much, I mean, such a socially acceptable, you know, behavior. And then you're trying to counteract that and show what the impact is. And you've got all these roadblocks or buildings that are trying to stop you from that. So it's, you know, research is hard because it, and I'll say that, you know, sometimes because of the stigma, okay, let's just put this out there. It's a lot easier for, and I'll say this, you know, it may be, I won't say it is, it might be easier for persons that are adoptive parents to say, oh yes, birth mom drank during pregnancy, because that takes it off of me, right?
I understand.
As opposed to birth mom saying, personally, if it was my child, is it easier for me to say I drank during pregnancy? You know? So you have that, what's the word I'm looking for? Variable as well, you know, that would, which makes it more challenging.
Well, yeah, because the guilt associated, if you're a mom and your child is born, whether or not it was anything that you had control over, and you find out that your child has a disability, you automatically just feel the weight of guilt. And I don't have that personal experience. I know that because of working with so many families over the course of my special education career, and then writing my book and interviewing individual families very specifically about their situations. Almost every mom that I spoke to had some sort of guilt, maybe lifelong, maybe just, you know, a short amount of time until they realized it really wasn't anything that they had done. But yeah, for this, and like you said, I don't believe either that there is a mom out there who's like, hey, I'm going to drink, and if I'm pregnant, who cares? You know, whatever. Right.
Who cares about this kid? I don't care. You know, right. Yeah, no.
And
absolutely not.
And in my area specifically, at one time when I was a teenager, so like 100 years ago, my county was third in the nation of alcohol consumption per capita.
Wow.
And we come from a small county. I mean, my whole county has less than 35,000 people in it. And at that time, I think it may have even been less people. But like you talked about, I mean, that's what we do on the weekends. We're in a rural community. There's not a lot of activities going on. So what do? You get together with your friends. You're hanging out. You're watching football or sports or whatever. You're just chatting and you have a beer.
Right.
And if you don't participate in those activities, you're kind of an outcast, outsider.
Yes.
And so, yeah, it's, oh my gosh. I mean, I am just thinking about all these moms specifically, but also, and this is going to sound strange as I say it, but I'm glad that there's some responsibility put on the dads for the alcohol consumption as well. I mean, I know that, you know, they're not going to get the diagnosis, but it's not all just going to fall on mom, because mom could truly say, well, I never drank, but dad drinks.
Right.
And like I said, I know that's going to sound weird. I'm not trying to place blame, but the fact that moms get blamed for everything else.
Right. And I understand where you're coming from in that. And basically we have to understand it's a society issue. It really is. It's not just one person. It's society. And I wanted to make sure to touch on the children that are impacted by the alcohol consumption. Okay. So it's easy to talk about, oh, they have a developmental disability. It's such a big word. What does that really look like?
Right.
Okay. What does that look like? Okay. And we're talking almost 1 in 20 kids, very conservatively, you know, potentially have fetal alcohol spectrum disorder based on a research that was done by JAMA in 2018. Again. So what can this look like? It can look like, depending on, like I said, the timing, the type, or whatever, and wherever the brain is being developed at that time of alcohol consumption, we're talking the central nervous system. We're talking usually what happens is like your basics are intact. Your breathing is intact. You know, your heartbeat's intact. Okay. Obviously, otherwise you wouldn't be surviving. So those you'll find, but then those areas that take longer to develop that are further away from, say, the brainstem, they're more impacted. So your fight or flight might be okay. You know, response might be still kind of intact, but your behavioral emotional regulation won't be there, might not be there, or academics or language or, you know, your executive functioning, your, you know, that CEO of your brain can't organize or manage time or regulate emotions, your cognitive development. So there's all different things. There can be learning disabilities. There can be, you know, developmental milestones or so many different things. And when I say behavior regulation, that's such a big word sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's behavior challenges. And a lot of it is because the child is misunderstood on what they need. And if we think about, I mean, so there's ways that we can work with individuals that have been impacted by alcohol exposure that have FASD that will help improve outcomes. But it's important to understand what it may look like, you know, I mean, it's important because we say these big words, you know, when we're in this, you know, we talk this talk and it's so easy to forget, well, what is, you know, behavioral, you know, or emotional regulation, what does that look like? What does that mean?
Right.
That's a big word, you know, I can't handle my big feelings. So therefore I'm going to go into a rage and destroy the house. I'm going to not be safe. I'm going to put somebody else in sit, you know, like, I'm not saying this is going to happen, but I'm saying, you know, things to look for, you know, as child grows, you know, and then one other thing to put in there is the diagnoses. When we were talking about, the doctors that are at, you know, that are confused about, you know, about telling parents, you know, it's okay to drink. We also have a lot of overlapping diagnoses because of either not reporting or there's a lot of what they call comorbidities or overlapping diagnoses with FASD. The most common being ADHD, oppositional defiant disorder, autism. And I'm not saying that people, I must clarify that.
Right.
If you have an autism diagnosis, that does not mean I am not saying it's rooted because of prenatal alcohol exposure.
Right.
Okay. Right. I'm making that very clear. But there have been individuals that have been diagnosed with autism where in fact, it has been rooted because of the alcohol exposure. It's not to say they don't have autism. It could have been, you know, so there's right. all these, and doctors don't know. I mean, I had a doctor tell me, I can give you an autism diagnosis for your child to try and get you services, but we know that that's not going to be effective for your child. Well, then why would you give me an autism diagnosis for my child if my child is really not autistic?
Right. Yeah.
So you have that with our healthcare providers too. And I'm not shaming healthcare providers either, because again, it's a spectrum and it's so hard to diagnose
right.
because it impacts everybody so differently. And there's no set criteria on certain
right.
things. So it's hard.
So how does one then go about getting this type of diagnosis or since it's not a technical diagnosis, how does one have this exposed that, hey, this is the spectrum that I'm on.
This is a potential. Yes. So, there has to be confirmation of alcohol exposure during pregnancy. Now that okay. does not mean that I, as the mom, or I, as a pregnant mom am the only one who can divulge that information. It can be verified by aunts or friends or family members. Okay. They can okay. say, you know what? So, you know what, if you're my sister and you've seen me drink alcohol during my pregnancy, whether I knew I was pregnant or not, you can confirm, yes, she drank during pregnancy. And that will stand. That's enough to dig deeper to see okay. if the child has that based on a variety of testings, so to speak.
And this comes through a doctor. Yeah. This isn't like you can take your child to your school psychologist and say, hey, I think, you know.
No, okay. it has to come. And honestly, it's usually a developmental pediatrician, you know, just like a developmental pediatrician would diagnose for autism. Mm-hmm. Usually that's the person, but there's not a lot out there. And right. so there's the other stumbling, you know, I don't want to say stumbling block, but roadblock in seeking diagnoses. So, there's very few, and people are looking for, you know, different places to go. I mean, I know there's a place, you know, in my area in Los Angeles, there's a place in Washington, there's ones in Minnesota, you know, but not every person can go to these
right.
places. It's
right.
not
yeah.
easy to go. Let's just hop on a plane and go get a diet. And like,
right.
that's not possible. You know, it's right. very hard.
And so to that end, how important is it as far as in a school setting, for example,
uh-huh.
knowing that bit of information, is it going to change the services that a child might get? Or I'm thinking in the case of where the doctor said, well, I'll give you the autism diagnosis so that you can get services. Now, I want to make this part clear that just because you have a medical diagnosis doesn't mean you're eligible for special education services.
Correct.
So,
yes, correct.
and so what sort I guess it's kind of a two-part question. So like, is it going to matter in the school setting what eligibility you fall under as far as, you know, if it's an autism eligibility or other health impairment due to ADHD eligibility? And then outside the school world, is it going to affect services at all, depending on if it said, yes, this child has FASD or this child has ADHD?
Okay. Those are great questions. So let's answer that inside the school system first.
Okay.
So currently there is no category for fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Right. Most individuals that end up with an IEP will end up with the OHI category if there is not another eligibility category, okay, such as like specific learning disability or emotional disturbance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Can it impact the school? Absolutely. And the reason why is because a lot of times what happens in a school setting is a child is misunderstood. in regards to what they won't do versus what they can't do. And the expectations that are placed on the individual, a lot of times when we look, when it's easy and it's been shared with me from teachers and staff in the school systems that when they look at OHI for a category, they automatically assume only ADHD because it's such a melting pot, or I want to say catch-all, of so many different things. And ADHD is the highest number. However, ADHD does not always have the behavioral symptoms that are associated with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And so sometimes the approach is different and the accommodations are different and the understanding is different. And, you know, it can definitely impact, especially as the child gets older, if there's been years and years and years of them being misunderstood. If I put a shoe on that is three sizes too small for me and I am forced to wear it 8 hours in a day, what am I going to do with that shoe? I am going to act out. I might take off the shoe and throw it at you. I can't handle the pain any longer. And that's what can take place in the school system. Then we end up with behavior intervention plans. We end up with, you know, potential issues with the justice system, all because it wasn't identified appropriately, that it was based on a brain-based disability, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and what that entails. Okay, so that's the difference. It's not just that it's hard for me to pay attention and I'm bouncing off the walls. There's so much more to it.
Right.
So that's, and it will impact services. Absolutely. You know, and it impacts placement and it impacts expectations. And as a child gets older, say they're out of elementary school and you're in middle school, the goal is, as you progress into middle school and high school, to increase independence and self-reliance. And a lot of individuals with FASD, it's possible that they may need some interdependence as opposed to independence. You know, so we try, as a school system, we try to remove services to, you know, watch them flourish and become independent, you know, so they can survive outside the school world. And in fact, they may need more.
Right.
So that's the school system one.
Okay.
Outside the school system is a whole nother story, because I can tell you that services for individuals with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder are about this much. There are not a lot of services, because the fetal FASD isn't a qualifying category.
Right.
Or regional center services, you know, different types of services. You have to show all the other stuff, so to speak. So, if my child is, you know, is struggling with occupational, you know, fine motor skills, then I can get the fine motor skills OT intervention. If my child has this, say, behaviors, then I'm being told to go to mental health. But mental health professionals are not aware how to, you know, traditional coping strategies do not always work with individuals with FASD. So, you know, we're trying that. And so we don't have a lot of resources to help parents with individuals with FASD in the home. And so the parents are floundering, and traditional parenting methods don't work with individuals with FASD. So the parents are frustrated. The kids are frustrated. Everyone's, you know, like it can be, like I said before, a perfect storm. There's not anything out there. So now I say that with the preface of, we're trying to change that. There is a bill that is being introduced called the FASD Respect Act through FASD United. And it is a bipartisan bill that they are trying to push through, you know, for approval, for more research, more resources, more qualifying categories, all of the things. It's something to completely check out and help get our politicians on board for that, because it's not a political thing. I'm not saying anything political here. What I'm saying is, to help the individuals that struggle with this, it is a big, it's an overwhelming number of individuals within our general population that are affected. And so it's something that needs to be addressed. It can't just be put on the back burner because of big alcohol companies trying to put the money into saying this isn't going to happen to your kid, or whatever it is, or who that fights themselves. So
yeah,
that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to get more services for these kids, because if we don't, where are the outcomes? What are going to be their, how can we help them? We want to help them.
Right.
I'm not saying that, oh my gosh, anybody who has fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, it's this doomsday. You're going to, write them off. No, there's so much potential and hope. We just need resources to help them out, help us out as parents too.
Right. And something that you brought as you were talking that was hitting my brain was something that you and I as Master IEP coaches are really taught in the fact that the parent is the equal member of the team. And we really need to, as educators, listen to the parent, because there are so many things that a child can have going on in their life, in their internal system. And there is no way, and honestly, it doesn't matter if it's in a school setting or in a medical setting or in a societal setting, that anybody can know everything about everything. And so when you're the parent of that child with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder or Ehlers-Danlos or Angelman syndrome or something that isn't as widely known as, say, autism or ADHD, we need to, as educators, listen to the parents, because they're doing research. They're going out trying to find what's going to work for their child. They want to help us as educators provide what really needs to be provided for their child. And we have to get past this idea of, especially the OHI eligibility, and I'm dealing with that with the situation with a client now where the school is just absolutely adamant that the child has ADHD, but there is no medical diagnosis of ADHD. And they won't listen to the parent. They won't hear what the parent has to say. And they're like FASD. There are so many things that are similar in appearance to ADHD, but aren't ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why it's key. I mean, I think this is something that, I'll be honest, as an educator, I didn't really understand how impactful the parent really could be. I always had great relationship with the parents that I worked with. And I tried to always include their input. And, I don't even know if I had making them an equal member of the team in the back of my head. It was just, it seems like the smart thing to do. Child every day in the summer, last year, I just think we need to do better about listening to their advice. So you, as the parent, tell about some of your experiences with your children and within the school district with them.
Okay. So I will start with my older ones that in the school system, we had a very mild, in the beginning, IEP based on speech. Okay, just speech, okay, no problem. And it wasn't until, but yet I was seeing things at home, but couldn't pinpoint what they were. The meltdowns over the homework, all different things. So fast forward to fifth grade, we're having little challenges. Now we're starting to have small altercations with the teacher. Teacher's a little condescending, saying things that are hurting my child's heart, so to speak. Now we move forward to junior high. We still only have speech. And now we start to see that something's not right. Now we start to see anxiety, panic attacks, refusals to go to school. Grades are dropping. All the things start happening, right? And so what happens is that the educators, and I'm not pointing fingers, but traditionally, teenagers get a bad rap, right? Just as a teenager, she's such a rebellious child, or whatever it is. He's this or this, let's put this person in the corner of the classroom so they're not a distraction. So now we've alienated the child and made them feel even worse among their peers, because now, so what are we going to automatically do? We're going to be defensive and protective of ourselves, right? Because now we're the odd man out. So now we're going to fast forward. We finally get an IEP in eighth grade to transition to high school. But with a lot of resistance, having to have, a mental health professional in, had to have them in the room with us to try and understand the needs of the child. Mind you, at this point, we did not have an FASD diagnosis. We were given oppositional defiant disorder. We were given ADHD. We were given all these other things, and mental health services. So all those things were given. Now we're fast forwarding to high school. And it just spirals. It gets worse. Expectations from teachers, expectations from peers. And then you've got this, again, another perfect storm for now we're having behavioral problems. And now, now we're going to have to do mental health counseling at school. We have to have a behavior intervention plan. And all the time I'm, as a parent sitting at the table, I'm trying to explain. I finally figured out what was going on, trying to explain it. And how I felt was as if I was making excuses for my child's behavior. I tried explaining, okay, this is what we figured out it is. It's a brain-based disability. And it's not that she won't do what you're asking. Her brain can't do this. And because she didn't look like, I have something going on. It was just, you have an obnoxious teenager. Issues with, altercations with teachers and staff and things that took place. And it was just a traumatic experience for my child at school. And so that was hard. And because what is the saying that no one is more educated than a mother of a child with a disability, right? Because I was all in and I was at the school all the time and I was trying and I just felt like it was falling on deaf ears no matter how hard I tried.
Yeah.
Now, fast forward, one of my little ones back in the school system trying, because the behaviors and things were presented as a child, I got specific placement. We got, certain things. However, we did not get certain eligibility categories for lack of data because of not being in a school environment. Understandable. However, I was trying to explain to them that the lack of data that you have based on what you did is in fact your data because, right. you were unsuccessful with this and here's why. And so we still had it fall a little bit on that, but there was more willingness because of the younger age to do a little bit more accommodations, a little bit more listening, a little bit more. So it's a challenge for parents, especially as the child gets older,
And I think that's honestly with any eligibility, because I do, and I've seen this and I've probably been guilty of this myself that, well, I see hundreds of students in my career as a teacher, and you're just talking about your one child. So I've seen these behaviors amongst all these age, all these other kids of this age, and your child isn't any different. They're just having typical behaviors for that age.
Right.
It's a cognitive bias. I mean, as I'm listening to you, that's exactly what I'm believing that these things are, and cognitive biases aren't things that we necessarily know that we have until they're challenged, and our brain just forms them because it's being fed so much information every single second that it categorizes things, and sadly sometimes it gets it wrong, and we have to be aware of that. And we, again, especially as educators, but also again the medical community, because I pick those two because those are the two biggest influences outside of a parent in a child's life, that we have to really hear what the parent says and take into consideration that they may only have one or two or six, in your case, children, but that doesn't mean that their expertise is less and should be just pushed to the side.
Right. And when parents come to, say, the IEP table or to a mental health therapist or to a medical professional, it's very easy for us in our industries to think, well, we've always done it this way. This is what we do. And this is a point in time where we, take that off and we kind of think outside the box creatively for this child. What does this child need in order for them to have an improved outcome? Yeah. And the, you know, well, we've always done it this way, or we've never done that before. Those answers aren't going to help the child more, you know, and the other thing, one thing as, you know, teacher parent conversation too, one thing that's so hard for parents of children with FASD is maybe at school, they're performing decently. Okay. They might be performing decently. Academically, they're just, you know, wherever they are, great, not great, whatever, but they're flying under the radar. Right. And so a lot of times parents, we hear, well, we're not seeing that at school. Well, we're not seeing that at school, you know, and that's because the child is in survival mode and that brain is working like in overdrive to try and fit in with peers, to try and meet expectations, to do all the things. So what happens is when they come home, they explode like a Coke bottle that's been shaken all day long. And that pot will top. So that's something to listen to the parents for too, and not just assume, oh, well, the behaviors are only at home, so it's the home environment.
Right. Yeah. And we also have to remember, and again, this is something that through the Master IEP Coach Mentorship,
yes,
becomes very evident. I mean, Catherine Witcher doesn't really require us to have homework, so to speak. But the one thing that she pushes is make sure that you know that the purpose of an IEP is to prepare a child for further education, employment, and independent living.
Yep. Yeah,
you're mouthing it with
me. I'm like, I can mouth it. Yes. But it's true, because we forget that piece so much. Is this serving the child for those three things? If it's not, then why are we doing it?
Right.
Let's lessen the load on the teacher.
Right.
Lessen the load on the teachers. They're the ones caught in the middle, you know? Right. So yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And we do, we having to remember that. And, you know, it's something that as a special education teacher, I recognize that the general education curriculum automatically embeds that within the curriculum. You know, the teachers that follow that curriculum, they're not having to think about those individual things. But in a special education world, we don't have a set curriculum. And so we have to remember that and go, oh, okay, yeah, well, if it's happening at home, that's independent living. So I need to figure out why it's happening at home and how can I help the child throughout the day not feel like a Coke bottle being shaken up all day long,
right?
That they need to explode at home. And I have had interesting conversations because now I do professional development for teachers. And I recently was at a conference where the topic of my professional development was collaborating with the parents to go along with my book, Those Who Can't Teach. And I had an individual get kind of frustrated with me because he said, well, the only people who really care about having that information, like having that draft IEP, or the ones who are sitting there with their lawyer or their advocate. And I said, you know what? That might be the case, but the reason they have that advocate or that lawyer is because they probably were not heard for X number of meetings prior to that one, or X number of years prior to that one, or they weren't getting what they were, or their child was entitled to.
Right. And
so, you know, we have to be careful that we don't automatically assume it's the home life or that they're just out to get us when they ask for this extra information that we don't typically hand out.
Right. No, we just want to help our kids.
Yeah.
That's all it is. And I know that the teachers do too. You know, they teach because they want to make a difference. So, you know, I love collaborating and being creative at the IEP table. I love helping parents figure out the best ways to work with their children and teens and adults with FASD. I mean, that's that age old saying, you know, it takes a village. Mm-hmm. It really does. It really takes a village of everyone on the same page to help that child and meeting them where they're at and, you know, bringing them along with you.
Yeah. And we can absolutely, I mean, it can be beautiful. You know, I mean, I've been in IEP meetings where everyone truly has the student focused And then we are trying to find what is appropriate for that individual. Yeah. And it's the most amazing meetings. And that's what we're trying to do as Master IEP coaches. And that's what you're trying to do as a parent. You know, you have both roles. And to get everyone, because it is helping the entire society when we are helping that one individual.
Absolutely.
You know, my tagline is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. And I truly believe that, because if we're writing appropriate IEPs for every individual, then we're helping that individual reach their fullest potential possible, which can only help all of society in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, however many years.
Yep.
Yeah. So awesome. I so appreciate you, Shannon, coming on today. We do have to wrap up.
Absolutely.
I just want to make sure that you've had opportunity to share everything that you had prepared to share.
I believe I did. If there's more information or anyone has questions, please, like you had said earlier, put them in the chat. I'll be happy to answer them. Feel free to go to my website if you want to. I'm sure Shelley's going to make sure that that's out there. If you need help, that's what I'm here for. That's exactly what I'm
just
here
in
for.
Case I forget to put it in there, though, it is Shannon Iacobacci, and it's spelled correctly, I hope, down at the bottom of the screen. I've had it there the whole time, so hopefully.
The first letter of the last name is an I, not an L. That's a very common mistake.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Because of the font. So it is definitely... Yeah, yeah. It's definitely an I, so it's shannoniacobacci.com, and there you can find some information on FASD as well as ways that if you have questions, how I can help you. So, you know, I'd love to help out. You know, I do trainings, I do parent coaching, I do virtual online courses, things like that. Just to help everybody, because I can't be everywhere, you know, and there's a lot of individuals that can, and I just want to help because I'm living it. So I have a lot of, you know, 20 plus years of experience also living it, not just what I've learned. So it kind of goes together. Yeah.
That's awesome. Thank you again so much.
Thank you for having me.
It's been so wonderful. I know we're both Master IEP coaches, but we really haven't had a chance to get to know each other. And so this has been great getting to know you and learning more about FASD. And I can't wait to see what the future holds, because I know that things are going to just get better. They have to.
Yes, they will. They will. We all
have to. Thank you so much, everybody that has joined us, and make sure you tune in next time, and I will see you again.
Hey, parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelley Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelley Kino, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelley Kino is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shelleykino.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shelleykino.com, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y-K-E-N-O-W.